Born in January 1933 in Louisiana, fiction writer Ernest Gaines spent his early years on an old plantation where his family worked for generations, first as slaves and then sharecroppers. As a child, he listened to the older folks' stories and helped them read and write letters, so it's no wonder he was able to vividly recreate the world of the South before the Civil Rights Movement. From the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman to his prize-winning Lesson Before Dying, he shared his approach to crafting his books.
When I sit down to write, I don't have a black face in mind or a white face in mind or the South in mind or anyone else in mind. I just try to write it as well as I can possibly write. That's all I try to do.
Listen to the past American voice of Ernest Gaines, a National Medal of Arts recipient and MacArthur genius who died in November 2019 at age 86 as the owner of that old Louisiana plantation, a place that fueled his work and gave insight into Black history in America. Stay with us to hear excerpts from two archive interviews with the writer and teacher today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Ernest Gaines' father left the family when he was only 8. His mother then remarried and moved to California, leaving him and his 6 siblings in Louisiana in the care of his disabled yet strong great aunt, who inspired several of his book's characters, particularly Miss Jane Pittman. After laboring in the fields with limited formal education, Gaines joined his mother and stepfather outside San Francisco in 1948 when he was 15, and that's where he discovered libraries, a place off limits in Louisiana. After a stint in the Army, he enrolled in San Francisco State University and published his first stories in a literary magazine there, which eventually earned him a Wallace Stegner Writing Fellowship at Stanford. By 1963, he realized he needed to return to the South to write, and that resulted in his first novel, Catherine Carmier. By 1989, he had 7 fiction books to his name, including his then recent A Gathering of Old Men, when he took part in the first meeting of the Fellowship of Southern Writers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where he was interviewed for New Letters on the Air by then-host Rebecca Presson.
What was the South like when you grew up? Is it just like what we read in your stories?
Well, you read my story as fiction, you know, but it's based on some facts, of course, and the rest of it is imagination. But I lived on a plantation. 6-8 of us shared 1 or 2 rooms, and you know, you went to a little one-room schoolhouse. I did all of that sort of thing, you know, and to go to town, everything was for blacks. I'm talking about the 40s now. All facilities for blacks were back of town, you know, to eat or to drink water and whatever you needed. So it's much like the earlier stories in the Bloodline series.
What happened that got you out?
Well, my stepfather was in the Merchant Marines, and he was shipping out of California, out of San Francisco and Seattle. And my mother had followed him to the West Coast. This was during the war. And I'm the oldest of the children, and I was taken there in 48 to be educated because they knew that I could not get the kind of education they wanted me to have in the area where we lived.
If that hadn't happened, would you be who you are now?
Well, I really don't know. You know,
were you the kind of kid who just kind of had all these ambitions along?
I didn't know anything about books, you know, because I was telling some people the other day, when I was a small kid in that area where I live, we could not go to the libraries. Where there was something called a library day where you can go there and look at books one day out of the year or something like that, or black kids, you know, in a little town. There were no books for me, so had I not gone to California, the time I went to California, I didn't know whether or not I would have ever discovered books and become a writer.
In A Gathering of Old Men, you use the multiple voices.
Oftentimes, you cannot tell your story. One character cannot see everything or tell you everything. And then maybe you don't want to go to the omniscient, that is, the writer telling the story. So what you do, you select characters to tell the story. It's important that each character has his own voice. You just cannot have 10 or 15 characters talking this very same way and having the same, you know, characteristics.
You write using dialect and using a lot of regional colloquialisms and so on. Have you always written that way?
Well, no, I have. I think the two books you have there, A Gathering of Old Men and the Bloodline Stories, I do use the first-person point of view. And most of my characters are people from a rural South and uneducated people. And so they would speak in the way that I have written it down there. But there are other books with emanation point of view, and that is I, the writer, you know, telling you the story.
You ever gotten in any trouble for that? Has anybody ever looked at that and been offended and said, oh, no, no, these people should all speak, you know, grammatical English?
Oh, well, I have students who tell me things like that, especially younger black students today. When I'm, you know, reading one of my books in the classrooms, and I do read all over the country, and they say, well, we don't talk that way. But, I mean, they're talking that way at the moment of time that they're telling me they don't talk that way. But they would rather not see it printed that way. Yes, I get that from many of your black students. And many of them don't like the kind of terms I use. But the people and the characters in the stories would have used those terms. So I'm just trying to put down on paper what I've heard.
Did you always know that was the right thing to do? Or do you have a role model? Did somebody help you reach that decision?
Well, I did a lot of reading. When I went to California, the first time I went to a library, I was about 16 years old. I'd never been in a library before. And I just read and read and, you know, just read indiscriminately at first. And then I would later studied creative writing at Stanford and at San Francisco State, and then later at Stanford. And I had teachers there who instructed me and suggested books, and books I had to read because I was majoring in literature, American literature, with a minor taught, you know, creative writing. And there were books I had to read. You know, you had to read the Hemingways, you had to read the Faulkners, you had to read Steinbeck and Jack London and all these writers, you know, and then you had to read, you know, the Russian writers and the French writers, and of course in English, of course. So you do learn from reading these people.
When did you get around to reading any other black authors?
There were no black writers being taught at this time. I'm talking about the 40s, late 40s, and the early 50s, up until the early 60s. You know, you were not teaching black writers. The only black characters you got were those characters created by white writers, you know. There was a joke at one of these institutions that the only black character we ever knew about was Othello, you know, and he was written by a white guy 350 years earlier. But, of course, you know, you had the Southern writers, you know, the Faulkners and the Eudora Welties and the Mark Twains who wrote about black characters. But we were not taught black writers at these institutions during this time, not until the 60s.
How did you find out about them?
Well, you know, some people had books, and some of the libraries had books. And after paperback became so popular in the early 50s, a lot of the black writers' books would be later published in paperback. So you could pick up Richard Wright's books at that time, or other writers' books at that time. And later, of course, Ellison's books would be available, and so would Baldwin's books and all the rest of the books at the time, yeah.
Did you ever go through a real political or real angry period? Your writing that I've read so far certainly deals with slavery and with civil rights, but you very often have white protagonists. You know, I mean, there is no, like, white hatred in your work.
If I have hatred, I try to put it in an art form, and you just try to put it down as well as I possibly can. I've had students, black and white students, especially black students, tell me they don't find enough anger in the story, and I said, well, I try to write it as well as I possibly can. They said, well, we still don't see that. And I said, what about the massacre scene in the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman? I said, what about the lynch scenes in the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman? I said, what about the scenes where this kid is cold in one of the Bloodline stories, and he cannot go into a place uptown because it's all for whites to warm himself? He's hungry, and he can't go into a place to eat. I said, don't you understand? That must be anger inside of me. But I'm putting it so realistically down there that they cannot. I'm not cursing. I mean, you're not using the curse words. I'm not using this overt violence at the moment type thing, you know. But so they feel that maybe you're not quite angry enough.
When it's like part of your daily life, it's more of a quiet suffering.
Yeah, I would think so.
And you can't get outraged every day of your life.
Well, you surely can't get outraged every day of your life. You're going to be a writer. You have to be able to control it. You have to be able to put it down so well that someone else could get outraged by it. And people, I've had students who knew what I was doing, and they read close enough, they could see the pain, they could feel the pain.
You told me you don't write the screenplays for the movies that have been made from your work. I'm a little surprised to hear that, since your dialogue is so strong.
I feel the same way about it. I feel I could write it better than the ones whom they hire to write it, but I'm not hired. I have no control over that.
So it's not a matter of you're not wanting to be involved in that. It's a matter of they're just wanting to take the work and twist it around.
They know what they want, and maybe they feel the writer does not know exactly what they want. He knew what he wanted to put in there. In most cases, the writers, the script writers, stick pretty close to, I'd say, about 75% of my dialogue, the way it is written. They stick pretty close to it.
That must be heartening to you.
It is, yeah, when they do it right. But other times when they make mistakes, you know, it's, you know, they make those mistakes too. And you're not officially involved, so you can't do a thing about it.
There has to be a sort of a pull in both directions, because there are going to be those people who watch the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman or A Gathering of Old Men on television and think they now know the work of Ernest J. Gaines. But by the same token, I'm sure that those productions help you sell books.
Oh, yeah.
How conflicted are you about
that? Well, you know, I was talking to a lady just yesterday, I think it was, and she comes and told me, a black woman, and she said, you know, I had to turn it off, Miss Jane Pittman, when I saw it. I think it was 74. She said, I had to turn it off because working around all those white people, and I knew I was going to be so angry, and I just turned it off. I just couldn't take it. I said, you gave your people such pain. She goes, it's such pain. I said, did you read the book, miss? And she said, no. I said, oh, God. I said, you see how much humor there is in that book. I said, Miss Jane's a great character. I said, there's a big difference between television interpretation of a book than the book. I said, listen, I said, my book covers 100 years in time. The television production was about 110 minutes. I said, it's a minute to a year. I said, they just got highlights of things and put it together like that. I said, that's what they have to do. I said, read the book and then you and I can discuss it. Well, regardless to what the television does, I can't complain too much about their interpretation of my work, although they, in all three cases, could have done better. But what they do, a television production does sell books. Even a bad production will sell books. There's no better advertisement around than having something on television. So you get something out of it. I wish they would criticize me on the basis of what I've written rather than on what they've seen on television or in the films.
The past American voice of Ernest Gaines, talking in 1989 with then New Letters on the Air host Rebecca Presson. He was at the first meeting of the Fellowship of Southern Writers in Chattanooga, Tennessee. By the way, that TV film adaptation of the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman won 8 Emmys. His 1993 book, A Lesson Before Dying, would also later become a film. Even though that novel had won the National Book Critics Circle Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, it didn't become a bestseller until 1997, when Oprah picked it for her book club. I interviewed Gaines the following year and asked if that changed his life at all.
Well, it sure sold more books. Because I think we've sold as many books or more books now than we did the first 4 years. Because of the Oprah show. She came down to Louisiana to visit us, and she brought the entire crew down there, and that's where the show was taped.
Did you actually walk on the old plantation grounds?
Oh, yes, yes, the same place where I grew up, yes. Yeah. We went there. As a matter of fact, we had dinner at the big house, the plantation house, where my grandmother had worked for many, many years. We walked across the yards between the cane fields, back to the cemetery where my folks have been buried for the last 100 years. We went to the small church, which is my school, my first 6 years of my life there on that plantation. We didn't have a school, so we attended school in the church.
Like the characters
just
in the book.
The characters in the book, right? That's, yeah. My school was a model for this particular school here. And we had one teacher, of course, at that time. So much like the things in the book.
Yeah. Well, I know one of the things that you have done is to use your own youth and where you were raised as a springboard for creating a fictional world, Bayonne, Louisiana, mm-hmm. and that's where much of your work takes place, I believe.
Yes, right. Well, it's sort of modeled after a little town called New Roads, Louisiana, but I changed many of the names to names of my family. My stepfather, who raised me, his maternal side of his family were the Bayons in that area. And, for example, the parish, instead of Pointe Coupee Parish, where I grew up, I call it St. Raphael Parish. It's my stepfather's first name. I name a river after my brother. The river's really Falls River, but I call it the St. Charles River because I have a brother named Charles. And so I just, down the line, I just change names and name it after my family.
In A Lesson Before Dying, Jefferson, who is a character we meet right in the beginning, mm-hmm. is caught up in a killing that he really wasn't involved with. He just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
And he's a fairly innocent boy. He's, what, 21 years old? But he's still a boy. I
mm-hmm.
mean, he hasn't been out on his own at all. And so he gets caught up in this, and there's a real gripping scene where they're in the courtroom and they decide to defend him by saying that he was a hog,
right,
that he
yes.
was an animal. He didn't
yeah.
have any more sense than
right,
a hog.
Right, yeah.
And that picks up the beginning of what becomes, you know, you defining what is manhood? What is manhood for the black man, especially in 1948 when this novel was set? Where is he in society? And I know it's a theme that you've dealt with over and over and over. Do you think you're working something out for yourself? What's going on here?
Well, I suppose it is trying to figure out things for myself, but in all the books, just as you mentioned, from the earliest short stories, The Sky is Gray, where the mother makes her oldest son, who's only 8 years old, makes him realize that, you know, he's going to be the man of the family if anything should happen to her. And that is the taking on of responsibilities. Jefferson had never had to do any of that. He never knew what love was. He never knew, because no one had really said, I love you, or anything like that, you know. And he just went along, and whatever he was supposed to do, he did it. Now that he has been sentenced to die for a crime that he did not commit and has been compared to this animal, and he believes in the beginning, he sort of believed that that's all he is, because no one had ever told him he was anything else. And I was dealing with that, and I was dealing with what does a teacher do, a black teacher in the South in the 40s, what is his duties? And in most cases, in a small school like that, small community like that, it was the teaching, reading, writing, and arithmetic, and not teaching about human dignity. And Jefferson's godmother, Miss Emma, she approaches the local school teacher, who is Grant, who tells the story, and asks him to visit Jefferson and to convince him, no, you're not a hog. You are a man. And she wants him to realize that, to be that man before he dies. At the same time, Grant, who is the teacher who tells the story, is supposed to teach Jefferson something about human dignity. He himself is quite frustrated with his position. He would like to run away, to leave the South, to go someplace else, to do something else with his life other than teach school. He doesn't want to be a school teacher. But at that time, this is back in the late 40s, there was very little else that a black professional could do but go into teaching. So he's teaching in this little school, but he doesn't like it. And he's not very nice toward anyone, the community or the children or anyone else. So while he's teaching Jefferson something about human, and he does, you know, he's against that too. He doesn't want to go up there. He doesn't want to be bothered with him. He feels that he's already dead. What can I teach him? What can I tell him? But Jefferson's godmother and his girlfriend, Vivian, convinces him that he should go to be with Jefferson. And at the same time that he's teaching Jefferson something about human dignity and that he is as much as anyone else and can be better than most of us, when Jefferson begins to come around, that begins to affect Grant, and Grant begins to come around as well. So it's sort of like an exchange. Each one is teaching someone a lesson before dying. Jefferson to learn something about himself and his human dignity when he has only a few weeks or a couple of months to live, and Grant must learn the same thing about responsibility to others and to himself. So they both give something to each other. Mm. That's part of this story. And you find that throughout my other stories and the novels, you know, that theme, that common theme, that someone must take responsibility to help this individual, but the teacher always gets something back in return. And that's what happens here.
Yeah.
I really wanted to do that story in the 70s, bring it up to the 70s, the 80s. Of course, a lot of things would have changed. I got in contact with the warden at Angola, and I asked him, is it possible? I'm writing a novel. I told him who I was. I told him I was teaching at the University of Southwestern Louisiana, and I had written the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, Gathering of Old Men, and other books. And I said, I'm writing another novel, and would it be possible that a school teacher, someone who's not kin to the person on death row, he's not his legal advisor, and he's not a spiritual advisor, a minister, would it be possible that such a person could visit this man on death row, this condemned man? So he wrote me back a letter and said, I could not afford the protection. And I wrote him back. I said, well, I don't mean that I'd want to come there and visit. I said, is it possible within a story that could happen? So, of course, he never did answer the second letter. And a friend of mine, who's dead now, told me about a case that had happened back in the 40s. And he said, there's a lot of material in here that you can read up on if you don't know these things. And I said, yes, I'd like to do it. And since I'd written so much of my other works within the 40s and the 30s and the 40s, I thought, okay, that'd be a good idea if I can move this story back to that point. I'd have to think about it again, think it all over, and move it back to that point. And then my friend Paul Nolan gave me some material. And in this material, I found out about the juries, and I found out how soon a person could be sentenced to die. And I found out things about, during that time in Louisiana in the 40s, you had this traveling electric chair. You were not executed at the state penitentiary, but the chair would come to the parish seat, the jail, within the area where the crime had been committed, and there the person would be executed. So I found out all of these things by reading what Paul had given me. And I also found out the size of jail cells and what people would eat at that time and these little things like this. And then I interviewed people. So I got all this information by talking to different people. I visited jails. I talked to sheriffs who had been responsible for execution, officiated executions, you know. All of these things I did.
The late Ernest Gaines talking about his novel, A Lesson Before Dying, back in 1998 on New Letters on the Air. We also discussed his literary influences, including books by Russian writers such as Anton Chekhov that he discovered in his early days at the library.
Chekhov, Turgenev, especially Turgenev. And if you read Turgenev's Fathers and Sons, or Fathers and Children, depending on how it's translated, and you read my first novel, Catherine Cormier, you can see a lot of parallels. There's a guy coming back from the university to the old place, and he doesn't fit in with the old people anymore. And he falls in love with a beautiful woman and, of course, loses her. I like the makeup of a Chekhov book because they were all small. I like Russian literature. I love it. I read all of the, you know, great writers, Gogol, Turgenev, Chekhov, Tolstoy, and Dostoevsky. I read them all. The Dostoevskys and the Tolstoys are too far over my head with those huge 1,000-page books. So I dealt with Turgenev, who could write the smaller ones. And he wrote about young rebels and young nihilists and young students and love and that sort of thing. So I was very much impressed by him. Also, at the time, I was reading French writers as Flaubert and de Maupassant. I read them. So I liked their writing, especially when they wrote about young love and when they wrote about peasantry and serfs, you know. I like the way they did it.
Well, you can certainly see a parallel there between the world of the peasant and the serf and the world of rural Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Once I saw that comment, I thought, oh, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So is Joyce somebody you enjoy reading?
Oh, yes. I've read Joyce, and I had to study Joyce in college. And I had to study Ivy Dean in the committee room in college. But the Dubliners. What I got from Joyce more than anything else was how to put a story in one day, as he does in Ulysses and as he does in so many of his stories. And, of course, I did A Gathering of Old Men in one day with many, many flashbacks, but the whole tragedy takes place in one day. And I got that from having read Joyce.
Oh, that's interesting.
And, of course, the stream of consciousness I got from both Joyce as well as Faulkner. But I think I had gotten from Joyce maybe before I read Faulkner, before I really got seriously about Faulkner.
Well, you can't help but compare your work to Faulkner just because you've created this world
in much
the way that Faulkner created his
world. Well, yes,
world.
And Faulkner created his world. I mean, what the others, Joyce did the same thing. Everything Joyce writes about is Dubliners, you know. So, and Faulkner knew Joyce's work.
And Chekhov did the same
Balzac did the same thing with Paris. And I think Sherwood Anderson with his little area in Winesburg, Ohio. It's one of those things that just comes down through the ages. And by reading, you know, someone once said that to be influenced by one writer is plagiarism. To be influenced by 100 makes you a genius. So, you know, to steal from everybody, you know, take a little bit from everybody.
Well, you know, what I'm impressed with just talking to you right now is it sounds as if you've systematically studied writers and what they've done and what you've really liked about this writer and what he's done to be successful in creating the effect that he wants to do. Is that true? I mean, did you really just study it, or did you read a novel and think, oh, I like this. Why do I like this? I mean, did you really?
Well, I studied literature in college. I studied creative writing as well as American literature in college. Of course, my teachers pointed out what made this book strong, what made it weak, and where it was stronger and weaker. And, of course, after leaving college, since I wanted to be a writer, then I just read as many of these writers as I could. And you learn from those writers. You know, you learn from people. You learn from Faulkner. I think Faulkner was, at registering time, a moment of action. Faulkner, I don't know anybody better than Faulkner at registering that moment of action. He's also great. Faulkner's very funny when he writes about humorous things. Of course, he had a great ear for dialogue and dialects. And I get that from him. Yet, I don't like those long, convoluted sentences. So I leave the sentence structure out when I'm dealing with Faulkner, and I get what I can hear from him. But I go to the others, like Hemingway, for the straighter, more simple, direct sentences and paragraph, building of paragraphs. I think I learned the thing about grace under pressure from Hemingway, and you find that in these books. You know, what do you do at the moment that the pressure come down on you? What do you do? How do you act? What is manliness? And manliness is not Hemingway's machoism, you know, grace under pressure, but how to handle an idea, how to handle any situation. Not necessarily the bullfight or war or the boxing ring, you know, hunting or whatever, but how to solve a problem with another individual at a certain time when all the pressure is on you. And I've told many students that Hemingway was writing more about me than he was writing about the white men, because I don't know any group in this country's history who's had the pressure on them that me as a black has had on me. And I can point to quite a few who come through gracefully. So I learned that from Hemingway.
Your individualism is what probably sets your books apart. Yeah. They capture that universality that the professor in the book is talking about when he's talking about Dubliners.
Right, yes. Mm-hmm.
You do that very well.
My teacher at Stanford, Wallace Stegner, once asked me, "Ernie, who do you write for?" And I said, "Well, Wally, I don't write for any particular group." I said, "I don't write for anybody." I said, "I just try to write something that anyone can learn from." I said, "You know, I've read and I've learned from great writers, Russian, English, French, American writers." And I said, "I'm sure that a Turgenev, who's this aristocrat and Russian in the mid-19th century, was not writing for me." I said, "You know, but I've learned so much from him." He said, "Well, but he could have been writing for someone." He said, "Well, suppose a gun was put at your head, who would you say you wrote for?" I said, "Well, in that case, I'll come up with some kind of answer." I said, I'll say that I write for the black youth of the South so that I could help him find out who he is and help him understand that he's as much man and his life is worth, you know, as much as anyone else's life is worth him." And he said, "Suppose that gun was still at your head, who would you write for?" And I said, "Well, in that case, Wally, I would say that I write for the white youth of the South, because unless he knows his neighbor of the last 300 years, he knows only half of his own history." I said, "But when I sit down to write, I don't have a black face in mind or a white face in mind or the South in mind or anyone else in mind. I just try to write it as well as I can possibly write. That's all I try to do."
Ernest Gaines in 1998. His distinguished career also included Guggenheim and MacArthur Fellowships, and he was the writer-in-residence at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, where the Ernest J. Gaines Center was established. In 2000, he received the National Humanities Medal, and in 2013, the National Medal of Arts. His 10th and final book was The Tragedy of Brady Sims, a 2017 novella about a courthouse shooting. He died peacefully in November 2019 at his Louisiana home. His legacy is remembered with the Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence to inspire and recognize rising African American fiction writers. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine and is produced in the studios of UMKC's Communication Studies Department with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was compiled with Amina Dalton and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.